Okay, so it's good to see everyone in whatever Zoom, which is our new reality. I'm glad to be back giving Shiur in person, but one of the reasons to give Shiur on Zoom was I don't have to wear a mask, and I'm a bit tired of the mask, especially if I'm talking to a lot of people. But it's good to see everyone. I hope everyone is healthy and stays healthy. One of the benefits of using Zoom over Facebook Live is I know normally when we do it in person, parents sometimes ask questions through Facebook Live and then someone reads the comments to me. So now feel free to speak up, or you can message me through the Zoom chat and I can respond that way, whatever is easier for you. Okay, so as I've said in the past, I always love the parent-son learning. I love getting to learn not just with the students that I learn with on a regular basis. Okay, there's been a request for everyone to mute their mic if they are not speaking. I think everyone is muted. I don't know, Jill. Okay.
Sorry, I just keep hearing this echo. I don't know.
Does anyone else hear it?
Afraid not.
Okay. Yeah, I don't hear it. Okay. So I always like the parents on learning, getting a chance to learn with everyone together. And we try to sometimes have the shiurim that focus on the different times of the year, sometimes just general shiurim, and sometimes shiurim that highlight the types of shiurim that we have in yeshiva. So what I decided to do for today was take a shiur that highlights two of the courses, I guess, that I've been giving this year, and one for 2 years already at yeshiva. On one shiur I've been giving now for 2 years is Agadah, is the narrative portions of the Gemara. How do we study them? How do we understand them using literary devices, philosophical methods? How do we understand them? And the course which I've been giving this year on Tefillah, and how do we understand prayer in general, and more specifically the Amidah or Shmona Esrei, the centerpiece of our daily prayers. So what I wanted to do was combine both of these series and give a shiur on what is one of the most perplexing and complicated of the brachot, which is the bracha of Vilamal Shinim, the bracha against the heretics, which is complicated for many, many reasons. First of all, because as the Gemara already notes, this is not original to the Shmona Esrei, because Shmona Esrei means 18. And anyone who daffens every day knows that we do not have 18 brachot, we do not have 18 blessings in our daily Amidah, we have 19. And that's because the bracha against the heretics is not original. It's complicated because we're not really sure who these heretics are. We have no idea. Some academics and some traditional scholars will tell you that this was a bracha written against the early Christians, and that is the position of Rashi in some censored texts and of some modern scholars. But other scholars, the most recent work on this bracha was written by Ruth Langer at Boston University, called, I believe, Cursing the Christians? I have not gotten my hands on it because about the time when I started researching this bracha, we all went into lockdown and I have no access to academic libraries. So I only could get through the first few chapters that were available for free on Google Books. So at least I got the thesis of the book, if not all the details. But she argues that basically it's very hard to pin down whether this is the early Christians or some other sectarian group that existed in the time of the Talmud, and we know there were many, the Essenes, the Qumranites, and we can go on. It's complicated because we don't even really know what the original text of this bracha is, Because, not surprisingly, once censorship became de rigueur under the Christian authorities, this was the bracha that they attacked the most. And therefore, the first word, as we have it in our Sidurim, of Vilam al Shinim, the blessing against the talebearers, or the those who will report on Jews to the government, is almost definitely not original to the bracha. It's definitely not the first word and may not be part of the text at all in the original. The original was probably something like Vila Mishumadim, against the apostates, or Vila Minim, against the heretics, or some word that makes it clear that the issue is not betrayal of the Jewish community as much as it is theological betrayal of the Jewish religion. So this bracha is really, really complicated. And we could go on really trying to understand the bracha. But what I want to do today is understand one aspect of the bracha, primarily not through the text of the bracha, but the story that the Gemara tells. Because for all the other brachot, all we know is that at some point in Yavne, it was arranged. Now, it's not clear if it was arranged in Yavne, if it was written in Yavne, if it was developed in Yavne, but some early version existed before that and came to its final form in Yavne. But we don't know who wrote any individual bracha. We just know that it was established, the 18 brachot in Yavne. The exception is the bracha of the Minim, where the Gemara goes out of its way and tells us a story about when and who wrote this bracha. And what I want to do today is try to both use the tools of the analysis of Agadah, literary analysis, philosophical analysis of Agadah, to try to understand the theological message of this bracha, and what the Gemara is teaching us by going out of its way to give us this origin story of this complicated and sensitive bracha. So that's going to be our goal for the night. I'll share the screen. I purposely made this source sheet. People in my shir know I tend to shrink down the sources to very small, and I get rid of margins on my source sheets so that I can squish as much into two pages as possible, so that I can only waste one piece of paper from the printer. Or if I'm printing 10 pages, then it's, you know, 10 and not 20, or whatever the case may be. But on Zoom, I had no qualms about making it nice big font with translations to make it easier to see. So I'll share the screen, and what I really feel free to jump in, either unmute yourself or message me or message everyone, whatever you want, as we go through. So I'll turn to the sources. Okay, so here is the bracha in question. I've given you just the Ashkenazi version as we have it now, even though, as I said, it is almost definitely not the original version. And people who are interested, I can send you several academic articles, as well as very carefully articles written in the yeshiva world, tracing the different texts of the bracha. But this is the version that we have. Vilam al shinim al tihi tikva. These slanderers, and again, the original Mishumadim, the apostates, alti tikva, there should be no hope from them, for them. Right? This is quite harsh, right off the bat. V'chol harisha kirega tove, and all evil should be destroyed instantly. V'chol oive amcha mehera yikaretu, and all enemies of your people shall be quickly cut down. The Hazedim and the sinners, Mehera, quickly to Aker, uproot them, Utishaber, break them or smash them, Timager, Vitachnia, right? Cast them down, Bimhera Viamenu, quickly in our days, Baruch Ata Hashem, Shover Oivim, Umachnia Zedim. Blessed is God who breaks the enemies and humbles the arrogant sinners. Right, so this is a very harsh bracha. And we could have a completely different share of why this bracha is even proper. A different agadic direction to take this this issue is to note that in many other places, in many places in Shas, many places in rabbinic writings, we oppose praying for the demise of evil people. Bruria tells her husband in a celebrated passage in Brachot Daf Yud that when he was bothered by barbarians and he prayed for them to die, Bruria chastises him and says, you should not pray for the death of evil people, you should pray for the end of evil, you should pray that they repent, playing on a pasuk, where we don't say the chotim should be destroyed, but rather chataim, and what exactly the derivation there is interesting. So we can talk about why exactly here we seem to be asking about our enemies to perish, and not just evil to perish. Now there are some commentaries who deny that that's the interpretation of the bracha, but it's pretty undeniable that we are also praying for our enemies to be destroyed, as the phrase "V'chol oyvei amcha mehera yikareitu," the enemies, not just the evil nis, but the "V'chol oyvei," the enemies themselves, should be cut down. But that's the bracha as we have it. So let us see this this story in Brachot about the writing of this bracha. So the Gemara tells us, Tanu Rabbanan, Shimon HaPakuli, his dear Shmonasri Brachot, Lefnei Rabban Gamliel, Al HaSeidir B'Yafne. Shimon HaPakuli was the one who arranged, and again, this is where that ambiguity comes, did he write them, or did some version of the 18 Brachot pre-exist Yavne, and they were just established and canonized in Yavne? But whether the writing or the canonization happened in Yavne, Shimon HaPakuli is responsible for it. So Amar Lehem Rabban Gamliel Chachamim. So now Rabban Gamliel says, seemingly at some later point, Klum Yesh Adam Sheodeh L'Takein Birkat Aminim. Is there anybody who knows how to establish the blessing of the heretics? Amad Shmuel HaKatan V'Tikna. So Shmuel HaKatan, Shmuel the small one, got up and established it. Lishana Acheret, the next year or in subsequent year, Shichacha, he forgot it. Now he didn't just forget it when he was davening, when he was praying his private Amida. Luckily, he was the Chazan that day. And I don't know how many people would have remained in shul under these circumstances, but V'hishkif Bashtaim V'shalosh Sha'ot. He was the Chazan, and he stood up there for 2 or 3 hours, trying to figure out how the words went, v'lo he'elu, and they didn't remove him from the bima. They didn't remove him from leading the tefillah. Now, why, parenthetically, is it the word to remove someone from tefillah he'eluhu, which literally means to bring them up? So if you, nowadays, normally the bima is elevated, but in the time of the Talmud, the bima, where the chazan stood, was not elevated, but was, you take steps down to go to the bima, to symbolize, mima makim kiratich Hashem, that I call to God from the depths. So they didn't pull him up out of this little chazan dug in area. They let him go for 3 hours. So the Gemara says, "Amai lo halu." Why didn't they fire him at that moment? The Amar of Yehuda Amarav Ta b'chol abrachot kulan ein malino toch bibirkat aminim malino toch. But Rav Yehuda wrote that if you err in any of the brachot, so we don't fire you from being chazan, unless you err in the bracha of the minim, in the bracha against the heretics, malino toch, then we fire you. Then we take you out from being chazan. Chayshinan shema minhu. Because we're worried that maybe you are a heretic, you're a sectarian. And therefore, you don't want to recite the bracha against the heretics or against the sectarians because you view yourself as being the target of the rabbinic ire. And therefore, if you fail to say that bracha, we're worried that you are in fact a renegade, apostate Jew. So why didn't they take Shmuel HaKatan out from being Chazan. Now in the Yerushalmi it actually says it's not only Birkat HaMinin, the same is true of the Brachav Tchiyat HaMetim, because many of the sectarians deny the world to come. But in the Bavli it's only the Birkat HaMinim. So why didn't they fire him? So the Gemara answers, Shaini Shmuel HaKatan De'iu Takana. Shmuel HaKatan is different, and for those who want to follow along in the English, it's immediately following in the source sheet. Maybe Shmuel HaKatan was different because he established the bracha, and therefore you could be certain that he had not become one of the sectarians. The Gemara says, why not? The Nechush Dilma Hadarbe. Maybe he went off the path. Maybe a year ago he was on the rabbinic side writing the bracha against the heretics. And now he had a change of heart and he actually joined whichever sectarian group or groups this bracha is aimed at. So Amar Abaye, Gemirei Tava lo have bisha. Because we have a tradition that the good don't go off. The Gemara says, really? But the pasuk says that sometimes the righteous do turn away from their goodness and they are engaged in iniquity. So the Gemara says, "Ahu rasha miikaro." That's someone who's evil, then repents, so sometimes they revert. Aval tzadik miikaro lo. But if he was always righteous, then we're sure he won't become evil. The Gemara says, really? Velo. Vatnan. But the Mishnah tells us, "Al ta'amin ba'atzmecha ad yom motcha." Don't have faith in yourself until the day that you die. Sharei Yochanan Kohen Gadol Shimesh Bikuna Gdola Shmonim Shana. Because Yochanan Kohen Gadol was the Kohen Gadol for 80 years. Ulubasof. And yet at the end, Naset Stuki became a Sadducee. Amar Abaye Hu Yanai Hu Yochanan. Nah, that doesn't prove it. Maybe he used to be Yanai, who was evil. Then he became Yochanan, the Tzaddik, and then he went back. Rav Amar, no, Yanai Lechod, V'Yochanan Lechod, Yanai Rasha Mi'ikaro, V'Yochanan Tzaddik Mi'ikaro. No, they're two different people, one who was evil, one who was good. So Hanichal Abaye, so okay, according to Abaye, it's fine, because he started evil, he became good. Elul Rav Akasha, so Amar Lecha Rav, Tzaddik Mi'ikaro, Nami Dilma Hader Bey. You're right, even good people were good their whole life, at the last minute they could become bad. So back to original question. So why didn't they fire this Shmuel HaKatan? So shiny Shmuel HaKatan dat chilbei. It's different because he started the bracha. He got confused. He said, v'laminim v'lamushumadim al tehi tikva, and then he just lost his train of thought. He couldn't pick it up for 3 hours. Why no one prompted him, I don't know. Maybe no one else knew the bracha. Who knows? Everything being by heart, it's possible no one knew the bracha. But he started it, which showed that he didn't hold any reservations about cursing the sectarians, and therefore we knew he wasn't a heretic, so we allowed him to continue. D'amar Rav Yehuda Amar Ravi, Tamer Rav Yishuv ben Levi, lo shanu elo shelo hitchil ba, aval hitchil ba gomra. Because Rav Yehuda had cited Rav, or Rav Yishuv ben Levi, as saying that if he had not started the bracha, so then we're worried he's a heretic. But once he starts cursing the sectarians, so we know that he does not identify with that group. Okay, so here we have a story. And as you can tell, the Gemara goes through great lengths to tell us about how Shmuel HaKatan wrote this bracha, how this bracha is written by someone different then the rest of Shmona Asrei, which was written or arranged or whatever by Shimon HaPekuli. But this is by Shmuel HaKatan. And for some reason, it's not just it was written by Shmuel HaKatan, but this Gemara tells us, right? Let's try to analyze what we know from this Gemara. This Gemara tells us that it wasn't by chance that he wrote it, because Rabban Gamliel, who was the head, he was the political and rabbinic head of the institution at Yavne. He is incapable of writing the bracha. And apparently everybody else in the yeshiva is as well. Because the Gemara tells us that he turns to people and says, is there anybody capable of writing this bracha? Which tells you that there's something about this bracha that makes it difficult to write. And Shmuel HaKatan is uniquely qualified to write the bracha. And I think if you look at this Gemara, the Gemara is already giving us a hint that there's something here. If you want to understand the bracha against the heretics, you want to have a full theological picture of what Chazal want out of this bracha, you've got to realize that there's something unique about it, and that Shmuel HaKatan is in some way the key to understanding the nature of this bracha. And in order to understand that, we need to get into the mind of Shmuel HaKatan. Okay? So, I throw it out to you. What do we know? What possibility, what possible directions can we take to understand why it is that Shmuel HaKatan is critical here? What might we be looking for?
Not being bloodthirsty.
Okay, good. Right? So Yosef makes... I think that was Yosef. Suggests that maybe this bracha is the type of bracha that it's very easy to get caught up in its harsh rhetoric. We don't think that just everybody can write that rhetoric, because you don't want someone to write that rhetoric who could write that rhetoric about anybody. Right? There are some people that they could write a diatribe, a curse, a damnation of the person who cut them in line, drove too slowly or too quickly in front of them or behind them on the highway, their boss, their co-workers, that type of person is not the right person to write the bracha. And maybe there's something about Shmuel HaKatan that makes it that for him, this bracha is sincere in a way that we can't expect from other people, and because of the harshness of this bracha and the fact that we're not usually comfortable cursing people, we needed someone who we could be sure would only be cursing people, shall we say, for the right reasons, or alternatively is cursing them in only as much as is necessary, or in a detached way, rather than because he's just an angry personality. If that was the case, then we should start looking for indications that perhaps Shmuel HaKatan is that type of personality. And we will see exactly such indications. Good, so let's hold that thought. What else? What other possibilities do we have? Oh wait, I saw a comment. Let me just look at the chat. Right? So Bernie suggests he could have had an experience with the heretics. Good, right? It could be, right? If there are certain members of Chazal that we have indications that they were involved in some way with some sort of sectarians, and perhaps he had an experience. Now, we don't know much about Shmuel HaKatan, so it's definitely possible that he did. We can imagine it, and perhaps this will work with some of the things, but we don't know for sure. Right, and this is the thing with Agadah. We had a guest shiur on Wednesday with Rayitzi Blau, who he noted that one of the things in Agadah is sometimes, unlike in Halacha, you have to be open to the possibility that you don't have a good answer. Because the Agadah, being literature, sometimes purposely leaves some questions open. So we can imagine that perhaps he had an experience with the heretics and therefore had a way of capturing that in words that other people did not. And it could be that he had a bad experience and therefore was able to write the bracha. Or he was someone who was friendly with heretics and therefore we knew that his opposition to heresy was not personal, right? It could be anything. We can imagine. We don't know for sure, but that would definitely be a direction to take. David says, good. It could just be that this bracha, or any bracha in Shmoneh Esrei, requires some sort of Ruach HaKodesh, some sort of divine spirit. And at this point, as great as everybody was, that was in the Sanhedrin, or that was in Yavne at that point, none of them were all near prophets, shall we say, except for Shmuel HaKatan. Okay, so we have a few directions. So let's start looking through the sources, because the truth is that all these suggestions, when one puts together the Agadata, all the Agadot, can in fact be supported. And the Radbaz has a tshuva, which I usually do at the beginning of the year when I teach Agadah, where he suggests that because Chazal didn't want to spoon-feed you the messages in the Agadah, what they essentially did was they had a coherent narrative in their head, but they didn't want to just give you the entire narrative. So what they did was often they would cut up little pieces of it and scatter it throughout rabbinic writings, so that only the person who had enough of a bird's eye view of rabbinic texts would be capable of getting the whole picture. People who read the individualized texts would get part of the picture, but the full picture would be reserved for those who truly were able to understand Chazal. Okay, Nate picks up on a key word here, which is katan. And maybe the key is in the word that he's katan. Now, it could mean younger. And maybe the Sanhedrin was involved in some incident because they were more senior and he was too young to be involved. But I think even if we don't take that direction, I think Nate is correct that one of the answers might be, and this is one of those little details you have to look for. And again, right, Blau mentioned this in his shiur on Wednesday. Sometimes the key to Agadot lie in names, right? Especially in symbolic names or nicknames. And as Joel notes, katan could mean humble. And maybe humility is going to be key to understanding why Shmuel HaKatan wrote this bracha. So to review what we have so far, we have one suggestion that the reason Shmuel HaKatan had to write this bracha was because writing any bracha requires a certain level of divine inspiration, and maybe only he had it. The possibility that a bracha as vicious as this requires humility, and maybe katan indicates humility. The possibility that maybe there's something about Shmuel Katan's personality to make sure that he won't take this personally, because we don't want this to be a personal fight. We want it to be ideological. And therefore, we have to look for clues in Shmuel Katan's personality. Or, and this emerges both from Nate and from Bernie, perhaps in order to write this bracha, you need to either have been involved or not been involved in some key incident with the heretics. And maybe either he was involved, as Bernie suggests, or he, Dafka, was not involved because he was too young to have been part of that fight, as Nate suggests. And as we'll see, if you go through the Agadot, you can support basically all of these reads based on other clues that the Gemara gives us in elsewhere in rabbinic writings. So, you go to source 3. The Gemara in Megillah tells us, Tfilah minalan, where do we get prayer from? So, here I'll read in the English. The Gemara asks, from where do we derive this? And it is taught in the Braita, Shimon HaPikuli arranged the 18 blessings of Amidah prayer before Gamliel in their fixed order in Yavne, which indicates that there is a specific order to these blessings that must not be changed. B'Yochanan said, and some of them taught in a Braita, 120 elders, the men of the great assembly, and among them several prophets, established the 18 blessings of the Amidah in their fixed order, which also shows that the order of these blessings may not be changed. So here, in the seminal text about the writing of the Amidah, the Gemara hints at the necessity of some sort of divine spirit to properly write the words that will capture the spirit that is needed for prayer. And it hints at that by telling us that some of the original authors were prophets. The Nefesh HaChaim takes this as his starting point and goes in the direction, let me just make sure I got it right, of David. Right? That the key here was that Shmuel HaKatan was the only person at that time who had this hint of prophecy, this hint of Ruach HaKodesh, and therefore was capable of writing the bracha. So here, if you look at the Nefesh HaChaim, and this is also the position taken by Reb Ovadia Yosef in his Peirush on Pirkei Avot, Anaf Eitz Avot, which I have here somewhere. Another benefit of Zoom is I have my own shelf with all my books, which is a benefit. I have it somewhere here. So he writes, Ha'ikar b'avodah tefila, shebe'ed ha'adam motzi mipiv kol teva mitfila, yitzayer lo azmach shavto ezo ha'teva ba'otiyotek, tsurata, the Nefesh HaChaim, Reb Chaim Volozhin, is a bit of a mystical work. And he writes that as you're praying, you should imagine the letters and the words, ulechavein lahosiv ayada koach hakdusha, and imagine that you're adding the holiness, shi'asepri lamala laharbot kdushatam ve'oram. And then if we skip down a bit, he writes that this is especially true of the Shmona Esrei. Well, if you go to Torah Kavanah, came to Gadel Maaseh, etc., based on the purity of intent, so the action will be greater. If you pray in any language, so you'll fulfill your obligation. But there's a special power of dominating the original language. And based on this, as I mentioned, Bavadi Yosef says, well, you see that you need this Ruach HaKodesh to capture that mystical powers of the letters. And Shmuel HaKatan, we know, had such powers. Now, how do we know that he had such powers? Are we just guessing because he wrote the Bracha? So as I said, to understand Agadah, you need to, right, you need to ask the right questions and then survey, well, as much of rabbinic text as you can get your hands on, and you'll see that we're going to be going through all types of rabbinic texts from all periods, from Tannaitic, Amoraic periods, and we're going to see that, in fact, Shmuel HaKatan is said to have had this quasi-prophetic capability. So if you look, for example, in the Tosefta and Sota number 5, the Tosefta writes, Shuv ma'aseh, shenit kansu chachamim biyavne, v'yatsa bat kol v'amra lehen. There was a story that all the sages were in Yavne, and a heavenly voice came out and said, Yesh kan adam shera'ui l'ruach ha'kodesh, ela she'ein doro zakai l'kach. There is a person here who's worthy of the Holy Spirit, but his generation is not worthy, so he doesn't get it. Natnu einehem behilel azakein. So they looked at Hillel. Ukishemet amru ha'ana ve'chassid. They said, oh, he was humble, he was righteous. Talmido shel Ezra, he was a student of Ezra. Great. And then it happened again. Shuv pa'machar, a different time. Yoshvin b'Yavne, they were in Yavne again. So apparently this happened a lot. Vishamu bathkal, another heavenly voice came out. Omer, yesh kan adam shera'ui l'ruach ha'kodesh. I really do wonder what this heavenly voice sounded like. You know, in my imagination, the way it sounds is when I was in Toronto, they had in one of the funeral halls, they have the Cohen's box. Do they have this in funeral homes where you live? Sometimes they have a Cohen's box, which is not technically part of the building, so Kohanim can come to funerals. So it happened to be that the Mara D'Atra of the Bayit in Toronto, Rabbi Karabkin, is a Kohen, and he has a very sonorous, deep rabbinic voice. But he gives the eulogies from the Cohen's box, and they just project it. And this voice just sort of emanates around the room, right? And it's very, like, soothing and spiritual sounding and commanding. So I sort of imagine that Ruach HaKodesh is something like that, but I honestly have no idea. I see a comment. Amen. We should hear a batkal ourselves one day. The, you know, like the Ravid writes, he heard it in his Beit Midrash, but you know, I can say a lot of things about how wonderful Beit Midrash is, but a Bat Kol has not yet come. And to be fair, with all the rationalists in Migdal, I'm not sure what we would do with it. I'll be honest. And Lichter is laughing. Okay, good. So Ella, Sheina Dora Oilakach. So again, so they said, now who's the person who's worthy? Time two. Natnu Einehem, B'Shmuel HaKatan. Shmuel HaKatan was the one they looked at. Bishat mitato, when he died, Ma'ayomer, what they said about him, the same they said about Hillel. Anav, chassid, there is no humble person, where is the chassid? The righteous one, Talmido, shel Hillel azakein. Okay. If you look in Masechet Smachot, which one of the Masechtot Ktanot, So you get another description of this type of scene, and he writes, "Kishinichnas Rabin Gamliel Zakein Matzash." Oh, sorry. That moves to our next point. So stopping at this point, we have support for the first possibility. That perhaps the reason that Shmuel HaKatan had to write this bracha was simply that all of tefillah has some sort of mystical power, and you need to be tuned in to that spiritual level. And Shmuel HaKatan was one of the unique people. And as the Tosefta in Sotah tells us, there was no one else in Yavne like him. So it could be as simple as that. Possibility two, we mentioned, is maybe we needed someone humble. Right? This was Nate's possibility from Katan. That the key is the word Katan, maybe that he's humble. And someone else suggested that as well. I have to look back at the chats. And in this Tosefta, we already see that. What did you say, Yaakov?
I said Joel.
Oh, Joel. Right? And Joel suggested this as well, that the issue might be his humility. Right? That we don't want someone who's all full of himself and therefore, you know, takes it personally. That somebody is attacking him, opposes him. We already see the hints of this unique aspect of his personality in the fact that when he died, and these were the key words, they said about him, Eyanav Echasid. Where is this humble one? Right? There's no longer this humble one. So we know that that is part of his personality. And we will see that it wasn't just that he was humble, but that humility expressed itself in a willingness to give up on honor, or even to endure a certain level of humiliation to protect others. And that type of personality is, again, the type of personality you might want writing a bracha that can too easily be one about ego and about personal feuds rather than about ideological ones. So if you look at the passage in Masechet Smachot here in 6, Kishenichnas Rabbi Gamliel Zakein, once Rabbi Gamliel went up to a meeting he was having, and Matzah Shmone, he found 8 people, and the background to the story is that he had instructed 7 people to be invited, and he found 8. So someone came uninvited. Mihu zeh shenichnas lo bereshut, who came in without permission? Amad lo Shmuel HaKatan biraglav. So Shmuel HaKatan gets up, V'amar Rebbe halachti v'nechnasi lish'ol. It was me. Right? I wanted to be here. I wanted to learn Torah, but it's me. I wasn't worthy. He said, yeah, right. Amar lo eldad u'meidad shekol Yisrael yodin she'ilu amarti sheikansu ala shnayim shayita echad mehen. He said, look, he invokes a story of Eldad and Meidad. So in Sefer Bamidbar, we find out that Moshe appoints the Skenim. There are 70 Skenim. Now, as Chazal tell the story, there are 70. But there is no way of dividing 70 equally by 12. So you can't get 12 equal judges, an equal number of judges for each of the 12 tribes. So what did they do? They picked 6 people from each tribe to be a judge. And then they made a lottery with 72 pieces of paper, of which 70 said judge and 2 were blank. And if you got the blank ones, you didn't get to be a judge. Eldad and Medad, as the Gemara tells it, were humble and said, it can't be us. And therefore, they just left. What happened? In the merit of them leaving and showing that humility, they became the highest level prophets of the rest of the Zkenim, and they prophesied even without Moshe in the camp. That's the Chazal story of Eldad and Medad. And according to the Nevi'im HaChaim in context of the Ruach HaKodesh, since we're not... Yes, David is correct. That based on the Ruach HaKodesh hypothesis, if you think every word is written in Ruach HaKodesh, we are missing it. And that is why, as I said at the beginning, the two groups of people who've worked on the original text of the Bracha are academics and Haredim in Bnei Brak. And perhaps the most rigorous article that's been written on it is by a Haredi rabbi in Bnei Brak, who we'll actually get to at the end, who I don't know who he is. But my guess, and you'll see it, is that the reason that that he is that in the Haredi world you've seen an interest in finding the original text is because they're trying to capture the mystical powers of the brachot, and therefore they're trying to find the original text. I think that's probably correct. Okay. Now returning to this point, so Rabbi Gamliel says to him, look, just like Eldad and Medad, who thought they were unworthy, but at the end of the day they were most worthy, you're the same way. Because everybody and all the Jewish people knows that if there was only one, if there were only two people who were going to come here, you'd be one of them. Because you are right up there. You are the best of the best. So here you see that it's not just his humility, but his willingness to sacrifice for others, even though in fact he's the greatest of the great. Ukshemek Shmuel Katan, Talum Aftecho Pinkaso Ba'arono, Bimnei Sha'ol Yoben, right? He didn't have a child, so they did symbolic acts as an extra mourning for him. And it goes on and talks about how elaborate his funeral was. Now, a similar story is told in Sanhedrin, and here I have the translation, so I'll read it there. So they had as well that they were invited by the Nasi. This was to intercalculate the year. So there was an incident involving Rabbi Gamliel who said to the sages, bring me seven of the sages early tomorrow morning to the loft designated for convening a court to intercalate the year. He went to the loft early the next morning and found eight sages there. Rabbi Gamliel said, who is it who ascended to the loft without permission? He must descend immediately. Shmuel HaKatan stood up and said, I am he who ascended without permission, and I did not ascend to participate and be one of those to intercalate the year, but rather I needed to observe in order to learn the practical halacha. Rabbi Gamliel said to him, sit, my son, sit. It would be fitting for all of the years to be intercalated by you as you are truly worthy. But the sages said, the year may be intercalated only by those who are invited for that purpose. The Gemara notes, and it was not actually Shmuel HaKatan who had come uninvited, but another person. And due to the embarrassment of the other, Shmuel HaKatan did this, so that no one would know who had come uninvited. There's a slightly different version of it that appears here in the Yerushalmi, where again you get this reference to Eldad and Medad. But we'll skip that for a moment. But the story I mentioned before about Eldad and Medad emphasize how Shmuel HaKatan, like Eldad and Medad, is viewed as this paradigmatic, humble sage. So I'll skip over a little bit here. They tell the story that the two men who remained in the camp was Eldad and Medad. And what was the story? So at the time that the Holy One, blessed be He, said to Moses, gather for me 70 men of the elders of Israel. Moses said, how shall I do it if I select six from each and every tribe? There will be a total of 72, etc., as I told the story. So, right, this is the story as I said it. We'll skip on to the next source. Okay. Now I will note that his humility is all the more surprising when you realize how great he was. So we already saw that in the earlier text, that Rabbi Gamliel attests to the fact that if there was only one person worthy, it would be Shmuel HaKatan. But in the Yerushalmi and Sota, again, you have this trope that he was Ra'ui L'Ruach HaKodesh, but it adds, V'lama Nikro Shmo Katan, so it gives two possibilities. Either, L'fi Shehu Maktin Atzmo, either because he would humble himself. V'yesh omrim, and some say, l'fi shema'at haya katan mishmuel haramati. And some say it was because he was only slightly less than Shmuel, the prophet, who in the eyes of Chazal are equivalent by who's equivalent by himself to Moshe and Aaron. Based on the pasuk in Tehillim that we say in Kabbalat Shabbat, Moshe v'Aaron v'chuana v'Shmuel v'karei Shemo, that Shmuel seems to be equated with Aaron and Moshe together, and Shmuel HaKatan was only slightly below them. Now, Rabbi Binny Blau, in his book The Sages, notes that it's not just that Shmuel HaKatan is humble and that he's even willing to sacrifice for his humility, but it's more than that. He wants the same type of sincerity and humility from everybody else. So if you see this story in Ta'anit, the story goes as follows. Rehuda Nisiyah decreed a fast, and rain fell for them after sunrise. He thought to complete the fast, but Rabbi Kiva said to them, we've learned, before noon and afternoon, the halacha is in a... Okay. Shmuel HaKatan decreed a fast. It once happened that Shmuel HaKatan made a fast, and rain fell for them before sunrise. The people thought to say, this is a sign of the praiseworthiness of the community, as we merited rainfall even before we prayed. Right, so here the people were getting high on themselves. Look, we said we were going to fast to bring rain. We didn't even need to fast. And here they're about to risk the sin of spiritual hubris. So here Shmuel HaKatan jumps in and he says, no. He said to them, I'll tell you a parable. To what is this matter comparable? To a situation where there is a slave who requests a reward from his master, either food or livelihood, and the master says to his ministers, give him what he asked for and let me not hear his voice, as I'd rather not have to listen to him. Here too, evidently God has no desire to hear our prayers. Again, on another occasion, Shmuel HaKatan decreed a fast, and rain fell for them after sunset. Based on his previous response, the people thought to say, well, if God answers us before we pray, because he doesn't want to hear us, so surely if he answers us after we spend the whole day praying, that's a good sign, because that means he wanted to hear us all day. And Shmuel HaKatan tells them, no, let me tell you a parable. To what is this matter comparable? To a situation where there's a slave who requests a reward from his master, and the master says to his ministers, wait until he pines away and suffers, and afterward, give it to him. Here too, the delay is not to the congregation's credit. Now this is a bit harsh, but what it shows is that Shmuel HaKatan is very wary, not just for himself, of staying humble, but he also doesn't want other people to rest on their laurels, to run into the danger of spiritual arrogance or hubris. And it could be, to take our second direction, that that's why he needs to write this bracha. Because as we all know, in ideological fights, take politics for example, it's very easy for people to fight because I'm better than the other side. Or, after fighting for a while, to become convinced that they're better than the other side and stop fighting for the ideology. But if you have someone whose personality is such, then not only is he humble and he's willing to sacrifice for others, he's selfless, but he also goes out of his way to make sure that other people keep themselves grounded, then he can write a bracha that talks about ideological disputes, because we know that for him, it'll remain on the level of ideology and not become, I am better than you because I'm smarter than you and you're just stupid, you're whatever. So the second direction is to say that the reason he had to write this bracha was because of his unique humility. And there's yet another Gemara, which I won't read because we're running short on time here in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, but suffice it to say that more humility is required from another rabbi. And Rabbi Meir acts in a humble way. And the Gemara says, from where did he learn the ability to be humble? From Shmuel HaKatan. The third direction, which is I think the strongest, is that it's not just that Shmuel HaKatan had near prophetic abilities and therefore could capture the spirit of the bracha on the right words. That may be true. And it's not just that you need to be grounded and not think you're better than other people and to be able to remind other people to avoid arrogance in order to engage in ideological disputes and keep it at the level of ideology. It's even more than that. Because if you look in Avot, Perek Dalid, so Shmuel HaKatan writes as follows. Shmuel HaKatan Omer, quoting a pasuk in Mishlei. Now all the Mefarshim say, what do you mean Shmuel HaKatan said? Shlomo HaMelech said. He is quoting a pasuk in Mishlei. What is the novelty of Shmuel HaKatan quoting a pasuk in Mishlei in Proverbs? He didn't write it. Shlomo did. King Solomon wrote it. So all the Mefarshim say, no, no, no. Avot is not necessarily about what people wrote. It's about what they said all the time, meaning what defined their personality. And what line defined the personality of Shmuel HaKatan? Shmuel HaKatan Omer, Binfol Oivecha Al Tismach. Uvikashlo al yageli becha penyira adonai virab einav veishiv me'alav apo. If your enemy falls, do not exult. If he trips, let your heart not rejoice, lest the Lord see it and be displeased and avert his wrath from him. And suddenly you realize that, wait a second, it's more than just humility or ruach hakodesh. He lived his life on one dictum, which was, don't exult in the fall of others. Now, Bernie could be right. It could be that he had been in some incident with the Tzdukim and he managed to not take it personally. Right? So it could be that he actually was involved in fights. We don't know. It could very well be that he engaged in these debates specifically because he didn't take it personally. Or it could be that, as Nate said, he managed to never be involved in this fight, unlike maybe other members of the Sanhedrin. I don't know. So whether he was involved in debates and didn't allow them to become personal, or he wasn't engaged in debates specifically because he didn't want them to become personal, one way or the other, what we know about his identity was that he defined himself as, do not exult when your enemies fall. And that, for many, especially modern commentaries, seems to be the key to understanding why Shmuel HaKatan had to write this bracha. And I'll give you quickly three possibilities, and I see questions are coming up. So let me run through three versions of this. So Reb Ariel Ephraim Aharonov, who I have no idea who he is, except that he is, as I said, a Haredi in Bnei Brak. I assume Haredi. I don't actually know that, but I'm going to guess that. In Bnei Brak. who wrote this excellent, thorough article on the original text of the Birkat Aminim. So at the end of that he says, V'echdom b'chidush katan. I have a little bit of a novelty. The Mishnah tells us that Shmuel katan omer v'foloi v'ech al tismach u'vikosh koshlo al yageli becha pen yirashim v'ravina v'shav me'alav apo etc. U'kvar niflu arishanam sham alo elu psukim v'furashim b'mishlei u'ma'u tzrech lezeh Shmuel katan. It's a puzzle in Mishlei. U'pershu d'afal piken ayur agila azir al davar zeb. Blashona pasuk. It's how he lived his life. Okay. Hine lefia mivuar leel ki echan miikarei advarim minusach berkat aminim hu levakesha mapalat oyvei Yisrael. Like kol oyveinu, kol oyvecha, whatever. The key of this is davening about your enemies to fall. So Rav Aharonov argues that what this Mishnah tells us is that the key is that Shmuel HaKatan took no joy in the fall of his enemies. He did it only for the sake of God. And therefore, he was the only person who could write it. Because if you're davening for the downfall of heretics because you hate them personally, then stop davening for it. If you're doing it because you care about the glory of God, and you think that heresy should be uprooted, then you at least have a right to daven. But if it becomes personal, if it goes beyond the ideological to the personal, then you can't do it. And that's why Shmuel HaKatan, who personified not taking things personally, had to be the author of the bracha. Rabbi David Aaron, in his new book, Soul-Powered Prayers, says similarly, and he notes that especially the words, kill them, destroy them, it's right, all these Only someone with the purest of intentions, solely out of the love of God and without any hate for evildoers whatsoever, could have the necessary attitude required to formulate this prayer. A close reading of this request reveals its accuracy. And then he notes that perhaps the bracha, he goes farther than Rabbi Aharonov. Rabbi Aharonov says, you can daven for the downfall of your enemies as long as you do it for God's sake and not because it's personal. Rabbi Aaron, despite the complexities with this textual approach, says, no, maybe, going back to that story we mentioned at the beginning of Bruria and Rabbi Meir, that Bruria says you should never pray for the downfall of people, but only for the destruction of evil. Maybe Shmuel HaKatan had to write this bracha because in fact, he was not davening for the people to be killed, for them to repent. And it was specifically him who never harbored personal hatred, who we could be sure would formulate a bracha against heresy and not heretics. And his close reading of this is as follows. A close reading of this request reveals its accuracy. It does not say slice them into little pieces or torture them. It describes a corrective process. We first ask God to cause the slanderers to give up all hope that their diabolical scheming will have any impact. Then we ask that evil disappear instantly from the earth. But note that it does not ask for evildoers to disappear, but evil itself. And therefore, despite the difficulty in reading this into the text, Rabbi Aaron says the message is that we know because Shmuel HaKatan never hated enemies, never hated people, that he would be the one to write the bracha to make sure that it was about sin and not the sinner. Rav Ezra Bick in his series on Shmona Esrei also picks up on this. And he writes, Shmuel HaKatan is the author of the comment in Pirkei Avot, do not rejoice in the fall of your enemies. Undoubtedly, that is why he was chosen to compose the prayer. For he can be counted upon not to allow the war with evil to become a personal vendetta. This is the paradox. Here is called upon to indeed aim the imprecation against evil personally, not merely against abstract evil. So Rav Bick takes the opposite approach. Here it is against evil people, or against the organized forces of evil, but against individuals as well. At the same time, he's qualified to do that precisely because even as he prays for the elimination of such people, he's not truly fighting them personally on the level of the individual, but only because their identification with evil has become so great that we cannot remain silent lest our identification with good be impugned. And yet, 1 year later, he cannot remember the text. And now he pulls out that note that Shmuel HaKatan can't remember the text. Why not? Because maybe this bracha is against the evil people. But this was so out of Shmuel HaKatan's comfort zone that he, on the one hand, was the only person who could write the bracha because he wouldn't take it personally. But because it was so out of character for him to write it, the words remain foreign even when they are necessary. To put it another way, the principle that our opposition to evil per se is absolute and unforgiving is a basic necessity, an unfortunate necessity of life. To imagine that it is possible to maintain this attitude while holding only benign opinions concerning all individual Jews is naive and perhaps even contradictory. That is, refusing to ever condemn personally a Jew casts a doubt on the necessary degree of true opposition to evil itself. This does not contradict another principle of life, the Bruria principle. Somehow we live uncomfortably with that contradiction as Shmuel HaKatan did. Personally, I do not think that you have to have any particular Jews in mind when reciting the bracha. I do not. But I do think that you have to be ready to do so, or else you are undermining your own commitment to the forces of good, the kingdom of God, and the sanctification of His name in this world. Okay, so let me summarize what we've seen. Let me take up the last questions and comments, and then we will call it a night. So, as I said at the beginning, my goal in this year was both to showcase the way we learn Tefillah and Agadah by piecing together the literary hints and developing the philosophy of the Agadah in its broadest picture. And the same is true in the Tefillot. So here we've developed three main possibilities. One is to say that the key to understanding this bracha is simply to recognize that all tefillot need a level of Ruach HaKodesh, and as we saw in the Agadot of Shmuel HaKatan, he had that. The second is to recognize that all disputes often become personal and become competitions of ego, And therefore, we needed Shmuel HaKatan, who himself was humble, was willing to sacrifice for others, and was able to teach others to avoid hubris. Possibility three was that the key to understanding this bracha was that Shmuel HaKatan is the one who says, "Ben fol oivech al tismach." Don't rejoice in the fall of your enemies. Now here you can have different ways of saying this. One is the way Rabbi Aaron says it, which is, if Shmuel HaKatan lived by the belief that you can never hate your enemies, it must be that this bracha is not really about the sinners, but about sin. And again, you have to deal with language. And I see here that Yaakov noted that some of the language really doesn't sound that way, because it sounds like breaking the evil, the enemies. You'll have to read it if you want to go in that direction, metaphorically. Break the evil in them, but not the evil people. Alternatively, you go in the direction of Rabbi Aharonov, who says, no, you can daven against people. Sometimes we have to. But you can never take it personally. And that was Shmuel HaKatan. Rabbik takes it even further and says, the only person who would be comfortable writing this bracha is someone who we know on the one hand would recognize that sometimes you need to call out evil and evil people, because otherwise you run the risk of being indifferent to evil. But at the same time, as you're hoping that evil is destroyed, and even the evildoers are destroyed, you can't be happy that you're doing that. There's a comment by a Catholic theologian that I forget which Catholic theologian, but I noted at the beginning of the year in one of my Parsha Shirim, who notes in this vein that it's actually important. You know, in Christian theology, they don't like talking about the anger of God. But this theologian, she notes that it's actually important to say that that we talk about quote unquote God's anger without getting into the anthropopathic problems of how God could have emotion. I don't want to get into that now, but simply because being angry about something shows that we care. And if you say that God isn't angry, so to speak, a million times when injustice is done to the vulnerable, let's say, that means he doesn't care about the vulnerable, so to speak. So what Rabik is saying is we needed someone who would be uncomfortable with it, but would nevertheless recognize that sometimes it's necessary to root out sinners and criminals who are hurting people. But he suggests that that's why the Gemara tells you that, yeah, when he was the Chazan, he forgot the text, because on the one hand, he recognized that it was necessary, but he was never really comfortable with it. And he had to write it so that even when we recite the bracha, we will be able to maintain that cognitive dissonance, as it were, that complexity, that duality, that paradoxical recognition that we need to root out evil, but being uncomfortable doing so in order to make sure that we do it only for the right reasons. Now, there is sorry about that. I cut out for a second. Now there is a little bit of a more depressing view, which Roger sent, which is maybe that Shmuel had. Oh, sorry.
How about you're muted?
Sorry. There is one more possibility, which is a little bit more harsh, which Roger suggested to me in the comments, is that maybe no. It's the opposite. It's Shmuel HaKatan used to say, don't rejoice in the fall of your enemies, because then God will make sure that they don't fall. Right? And if we really want to make sure that our enemies are destroyed, we need someone who'll never be happy about it. Right? That's what the Pasuk says. Ben fol oivech al tismach, because maybe God will be upset that you're happy about it, and then he won't actually destroy your enemies. So maybe the reason we needed him is because we dafka want our enemies to be destroyed, so we can't be happy about it, because then, ironically, it won't happen. So that is another possibility, focusing on the latter half of the Mishnah. Now, and again, some of the other possibilities that we brought up from both Bernie and Nate, that perhaps Shmuel HaKatan developed this personality because of something that happened in his life or didn't happen in his life, We can speculate about that, and it's very possibly true that that's how he developed into the person who could write this bracha. We just don't know, but it's very possible that that stands in the background of this story. So what I hope we've seen today is how, you know, even a short comment in the Agadah, to fully understand it, requires us to play a little bit of a game, a little bit of a jigsaw, put together the jigsaw puzzle. And then as we see, we may not come up with one answer, we may come up with multiple answers, but as we see, as the Radbaz notes, Agadah is made in this way, that in order to appreciate the richness, the literary and theological richness of Agadah, you need to search for all the pieces to put together the puzzle and then see the emergent picture. And here we've seen three or four directions that both give us insight into who Shmuel HaKatan was, why he had to be the one to write the bracha, and what it tells us about what exactly we're davening for and the mindset we have to have in this very complex bracha that really is problematic and out of character, and how exactly we have to approach the bracha. Now, there are other possibilities that have been suggested, or by Dr. Eli Confer, who's a non-Orthodox scholar, has suggested that perhaps the key here lies not just in what we know about Shmuel HaKatan, but in what we know about Rabban Gamliel. But we're already over an hour, so I'm going to stop there. And thank you all for learning with me and for participating. And I hope that gave you a little bit of an insight into the complexity in the Agadot and in Tfilot. And okay, hopefully we'll join again soon. Okay, everyone, stay healthy.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
See you guys later.